Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Black tar heroin out of Mexico has been a standard and a scourge for years in the West. But its explosive push across the country is something new, and the new method used to push it is startlingly normal. Door-to-door service and a savvy supply chain that may remind you of the Avon lady or Tupperware parties. But this is very different. This is heroin, made accessible and all too familiar in a new way. The LA Times' Sam Quiñones has documented the surge and the changing landscape of sellers and users. Here's a user.
It's very normal, I think. I mean, we have the same struggles as most people do. You know, we just have an expensive medication. We're definitely not the typical junkie.
Huh. This hour, On Point, investigating the explosive spread of black tar heroin. You can join the conversation. Have you seen it in your town, on your street, seen how it's sold? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear later in this hour from a DEA agent in Dallas and a rural Ohio psychologist who's dealing with a spike in black tar heroin use. But joining me first from KPCC in Pasadena, California, is Sam Quiñones, investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's one of the country's top reporters on U.S.-Mexico issues for the past 15 years. He's been writing on border and migration-related stories. He's lived in Mexico for 10 of those years. He's author of True Tales from Another Mexico. This month, his big three-part series was published in the L.A. Times about the spread of black tar heroin to Middle America. It is an eye-opener. You can link to it all at onpointradio.org. Sam Quiñones, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me on.
This is a remarkable piece of reporting, and we thank you for it. It's really really something else. Give us the big picture here, Sam. Kind of get us situated. Black tar heroin's nothing new, but there's something new in its spread and its distribution here.
Correct. Black tar heroin came to the United States for the first time really in the early 1980s, according to people I've talked to who are longtime users and so on. But it was kind of ghettoized in a sense. It was mainly junkies on the West Coast, a lot of California, Arizona, Texas also, Portland, places like that. And when I was a crime reporter many years ago at a small paper in the Central Valley of California, I just kind of learned that, you know, black tar heroin really didn't make it past, you know, the Mississippi River, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a thing that was kind of, very ghettoized. It was kind of like looked as really as kind of low-class heroin. It's semi-processed heroin. It's just as potent as any heroin. It's just looks like Tootsie Rolls or something like that. You know, it's not the processed white powder that you saw like on the French Connection or something.
That might have come out of Colombia or somewhere else around the world.
Yeah, well, today what the DEA feels is that there's pretty much only two countries that supply us with heroin, and that's Mexico and Colombia. And increasingly, Mexico is taking over the supply, the transportation of that dope from Colombia into the United States. So whether it comes from Mexico or Colombia, it's pretty much all coming through the hands of traffickers. Now, Colombia has powder heroin. Mexico is the only place that I know of anyway. Maybe there's some in Afghanistan, but Mexico is the only place I know that makes the black tar. And for a long time, as I said, it was kind of a ghettoized drug, mm-hmm. West Coast. And then in the mid 1990s, two prison inmates in Nevada made a connection. One was a guy from Southern California, mm-hmm. a longtime junkie. The other guy was from a small county in Mexico, a place called Jalisco, mm-hmm. which is not to be confused with the state Jalisco of the same name. This is a Jalisco spelled with an X, and it's a small little county in the state of Nayarit, where
this is down on the kind of the west central Mexico. I don't know, south of Mexico City, north of Acapulco.
No, it's northwest Mexico on the Pacific coast.
Oh, okay.
It's on the coast, and it's a very hilly area, mountainous area, and opium poppies grow quite nicely in those hills. So, one guy had the knowledge of the drug trade in the United States and how junkies operate. The other guy had access to both the dope and, as it turned out later, a vast supply of laborers who were willing to come up and sell it. That probably wasn't what they initially thought, but that's what eventually turned out.
Mm-hmm.
After they both paroled in 1994. One guy called Max. The other guy's name, actually, I don't really know. I have some hunches, but I don't know his full name. Max hasn't told me.
It's amazing. This all goes back to a couple of guys in Little Jalisco.
Precisely. Precisely. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And they begin to – they start out in Reno. And they what's happening in those years is that, first of all, pager technology is really commonplace. And they begin to realize that if we sell this via pagers, we won't need to be selling it out of a house. Selling it out of a house means you're a sitting duck for all the police surveillance.
But that was kind of the traditional way. Everybody would know some rundown place or corner where that was the spot you went to get the smack.
That's right, and it was really kind of a non-aggressive way of selling, in the sense that they didn't go out beating the bushes looking for new customers. These guys put drivers in cars. They had people. They circulated numbers of pagers, and the addicts now would call in, and they'd call the number, the pager. They called a number and they'd from a payphone, say, and they'd make an order, and the operator, there was a telephone operator who would say, yeah, okay, meet us at, let's say, the McDonald's parking lot at such and such in a corner, and then he would, the operator would page one of the drivers who's driving around town with lots of little balloons filled with heroin,
mm-hmm.
uninflated balloons about the size of a pencil eraser,
yep.
or a marble. In their mouths, and they have 20 or 30 of these. They got used to having 20 or 30 of these in their mouths.
Why in their mouths?
Because as soon as they see police, they're able to swallow them. They also have a big jug of water right next to them.
You can swallow 20 of these hits and survive that?
Yeah, sure. They've done it. They've done it. Wow. Some people, okay. I suppose, have had problems, but those balloons, when they're tied tight, they're pretty impermeable. And
but it's sort of like ordering pizza here.
Precisely. That's it. And you avoid – there's several benefits. Number one, as a dealer, you're not in some house, as I said, a sitting duck for police. Mm-hmm. Number two, you're able to kind of go to the customer. So your potential customer base is the entire city or a very large region. You know, you can go – and three, the addict doesn't have to go down to Skid Row. You know, or buying from some dangerous place. It's a far more a safe way of purchasing heroin for these guys.
Which and took it into new kinds of neighborhoods.
Well, eventually these guys figured that out. Yeah, they began to sell in the areas where Black Tar already was. Reno, they then went to, Max told me, they then went to Portland, Denver. These were areas that already had Black Tar,
mm-hmm.
but they began to sell it in a different way that police hadn't seen before. And what happens is, first of all, you're able to get a much larger customer base. That's number one. But also, the more of that stuff you bring in, that drops the price down. And that makes it accessible to lots of people. You know, you were talking about the way we imagine junkies for many years. It was a guy who was stealing TVs and stereos and robbing donut shops and that kind of thing. Well, this is not. These are not the, because the prices dropped so significantly due to the competition among these guys.
Mm-hmm.
You can support a habit for, as the one guy told me in the quoted in the series, the price of a premium six pack of premium beer. You know, it's a lot cheaper.
But it's heroin.
Now.
And they aimed it. They aimed it eventually. You write. Not at African-American communities or Latino
right.
communities, though no doubt there's been plenty there, but right into kind of middle-class white communities.
Right, precisely. And that was the attitude of Max. Max had this attitude, I don't want to be dealing – he's Mexican-American himself.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be dealing with blacks or Latinos. I don't want – he was afraid of getting robbed. They were always asking for credit. If you didn't give them credit, they caused a problem. He says, I want the white clientele. That's where the money is. Right.
Mm.
And so he began to go to areas as they began to expand, and he began to see the possibilities of this, and he saw how it worked. They began to target areas that really had that demographic. At the same time, I should say, meanwhile, they're understanding that they're back home in Jalisco, in the small little county, the size of like one neighborhood in L.A., really, in
mm-hmm.
terms of population.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a ton of guys who are very poor. And they want to come up and drive. They want to come up and learn the business. They want a leg up. And so the labor is unending. So drivers can be arrested, and they are arrested all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a whole line of them back home waiting to take that one driver's place once he's arrested. But yeah, then they begin to see this system can really expand. This can really grow. And Max particularly takes it east. Now, this is a historic change in the drug world in the United States. Nobody has ever taken More than a little bit, you know, from time to time, an occasional, you know, ounce or so
of this black tar heroin
east of the Mississippi River.
And so you say it. Never mind California. Suddenly, and Portland, Oregon. It's Salt Lake City and Boise, Idaho, and then Indianapolis and Nashville and Charlotte, North Carolina, Myrtle Beach.
Precisely, you know, they're looking for something very specific. He's looking for something very specific, and that is areas where there is no market, areas where there is no competition. There's no gangs or mafia like
Chicago. There's no big user base.
Precisely, but also where there's no big entrenched seller dealer base. So if you've seen The Wire on HBO, mm-hmm, that shows mm-hmm. kind of Baltimore projects and
oh,
so on,
smaller
they didn't
towns.
Go to Baltimore. Mm-hmm. They didn't go to Baltimore. They didn't go to Philadelphia. They mm-hmm. didn't go to D.C. or New York, where there are very large heroin markets, already established heroin demand.
Right.
They went to areas like Charlotte, Columbus, Indianapolis, Nashville, parts of South Carolina, and when they do that, then they establish in a big city. Columbus is a perfect example. And soon junkies from all over, not just Columbus, but from miles and miles around, figure out, hey, I could go there and get my dope. They were my dope for cheap, and it's much better than the kind of heavily diluted Colombian powder that I've been having to deal with up to now that costs triple that.
And so
I can buy my dope much cheaper. If I just drive a couple of hours to Columbus or Nashville or Indianapolis.
Right, and so it has just boomed in areas where it had not boomed before. And, Sam, you tell the story very well. There's a lot more we want to hear. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the explosion of black tar heroin across the country, and the door-to-door service and business model that's pushing the drug, cheap and potent, deep into middle America. Sam Quiñones is with us. He's just run a big three-part series in the Los Angeles Times tracking the growth and movement of black tar heroin across the country, and it's quite a story. We're going to hear in just a moment from DEA Special Agent James Capra in Dallas, Texas. I want to get a feeling for the kind of user that was hooked on this out there, Sam. You've gone out and brought back some tape. It's really interesting to hear. We heard this user at the top of the show. Here's a little more from him. You talked to a couple that had been addicted to black tar heroin since 2007. Credit here to Gina Ferrazzi of the LA Times who got the tape. Here's one of them talking about the black tar lifestyle. Doesn't see himself exactly as a junkie.
We're not the type that are breaking into people's houses
right.
to get our fix. It's
right.
not about that. Obviously, when somebody's sick, they go out and choplift or, you know, like
right.
we've done, but
right.
it's not what we want to be doing. It's
right.
because we have to.
It's because we have to. We're not, you know, we're not junkies. Steve in Windham, Connecticut. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I love
hi.
Your show.
Thank you.
Windham, Willimantic, Connecticut was called a heroin town. It had a series in Hartford Current. Dan Rather came down here with 60 Minutes,
mm-hmm.
if you Google it. And it's a black tar heroin. And we're the largest Hispanic community, Mexican Americans, Ecuadorians,
mm-hmm.
a lot of Central
mm-hmm.
Americans, Puerto Ricans. And we're inundated with black tar from Mexico. And it's cheaper than oxycodone. That's what I read in the paper. It's replace oxycodone because it's cheaper per pill, a bag of black tar heroin from Mexico
yep.
than one pill of oxycodone. And my push to the question is, what are we doing to work with the Mexican authorities, to work with Mexico? You know, this is not coming from Afghanistan. This is coming from North America, from Mexico.
It's a great question. Steve, let us pick it up with the guy who's been on the front lines, and I appreciate your call. Sam, there it is, exactly what you're writing about, black tar, plenty.
Right, and frankly, that was a town I've never heard. I'll have to look into that. That's a new town for me, but they're always popping up somewhere. So.
You can add it to your list. Let's go to yes. Dallas, Texas right now, and James Capra, he's DEA Special Agent in charge of the Dallas Field Division. He's seen a lot of black tar cases in his career in the border and western regions. James Capra, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So we hear so much about drugs in Mexico lately and the killings along the border, and we know it's nothing new, as Sam writes, in California and maybe your neck of the woods. But what about the black tar heroin flow and how far it's now moved into the sort of middle of the country and the east?
Right, right. Sam's article is really a good picture of how some of these independent organizations work. But one of the things I think that's important to know is Black Tar's been around, and I think, Sam, you said that for a long time, and, mm-hmm. and I've been on the job for just over 23 years and started out in L.A. and was there then. It's there now. But I think the difference is just like methamphetamine, what you see is this migration across the United States. Many things that we see within the drug trends have to do with a couple of things. First, never forget that these groups, these criminals, these trafficking organizations are in the business of making money off of the backs of addiction. Okay, so
sure.
so that a lot of times we forget that. We some people romanticize it and everything else, but individuals who have no regard for life, liberty, health, or anything else are in the business of making money off the backs of those people that are addicted. Black Tar has been around for a long time. Sam talked about independent groups that were there.
Kind of entrepreneurs moving door to door.
But I'll tell you something about what's happening is some of the market trends we see are a result of what's happening within the American people themselves and attitudes towards drugs in the past 30 years, what we're doing enforcement-wise and what we're doing on the global front as well, what's happening down in Mexico.
What do you mean on attitudes first, James?
I think a couple of things that are if you look back in 30 years, drug enforcement, a lot of things that you hear about, especially in the United States, sometimes on blogs and other things, that nothing has been done. Well, there's been a tremendous amount of work and success that's been done here in America, not just on enforcement, but on treatment and on, I think, American people's attitudes that illegal drugs are killing and hurting people, generations of people.
But I see a different story in Sam's reporting, a story of heroin now getting into communities that may have seen very little of it. And you
right.
heard in that clip we just played, and we played some of the top, I don't know if you heard, James, but the sense of, well, this is just my medication. This
right. Well, you know what? And to be honest with you, having dealt with people from major drug traffickers to being exposed to junkies over the years, mm-hmm. there's a lot of excuses of why who's doing what. The question ultimately is it's not that simple. And a guy who needs a couple of bucks to go score will almost do anything, proposes a threat to anybody
right.
out there. But I think if you get back to the story at hand about Black Tar itself is what we see out here. Let me just give you a picture. Down in places like Sonora, down in places like Guerrero, Durango, and Black Tar has been produced down there for years and years and years.
Mm.
If you look at some of what happens is some of these trafficking organizations, because that's what they are, they will intermingle themselves in the migration process of where we have workers coming in and everything else, and how do you fit into a community that way? But it's all about making a buck.
What about our caller in Connecticut who says his town is inundated with Black Tar heroin, and he says, look, this isn't Afghanistan or somewhere far.
Right.
This is right across the border. Why can't we, with Mexico, stop this?
Right. Well, I think what's happening down in Mexico, both with the Mexican government and what that president has done in the past few years, is extremely heroic. But we have organizations that are in some parts of Mexico that are running rampant across there. And to move the small amounts of heroin across the border doesn't take much to do. But there is, again, let me get back to the issue of why people, heroin, first of all, is extremely addicting.
Mm-hmm.
Out here in Dallas, let me tell you, some of the people have heard of this product that we have out here. It's nothing more than Black Tar heroin that's cut up and mixed called cheese. Let me tell you what they've done here. At the lower level, they've targeted these groups, some of them independent, not unlike the groups that Sam talked about,
mm-hmm.
but they're targeting high school kids, to some extent some middle schools. And now cheese is nothing more than Black Tar heroin that's cut up with an over-the-counter sleep aid. And it's sold, get
sleep
this.
Sleep aid, like a sleeping pill kind
that's
of
That's right.
Stuff.
And mm-hmm. it's sold for $2 to $5. And it's snorted.
Oh, my gosh.
Now follow me with this.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this marketing approach. Now, and here's what I tell people, and they say, well, you're kind of being a little bit of a zealot. Who sits back and says, you know what, let me market this. How do I get younger kids to try this? And tell them, it's $2 to $5. It's called cheese. It looks funny. Can't be harmful. And you snort it. That can't be harmful.
Mm.
Well, let me tell you something. Every drug addict out there starts somehow. And everyone who starts using heroin, whether they snort it first, everyone will go to the needle eventually. Eventually they'll go to the needle. And we've had a handful of kids down here in the past 3 years that have overdosed, and we've got a task force approach to going after the black tar dealers. But let me give you another example so you understand the mindset of what's going on. Again, these organizations are in the business of making money. A number of years ago, we had an operation on the West Coast, and we called Operation Tar Pit. Some of these same groups from Nayarit, some Sonora, from Jalisco, what they did is come up with black tar heroin. They tried to separate themselves from some of the major drug trafficking organizations. And listen to what they did. Mm. They went and targeted methadone clinics. Methadone clinics with their drug. So here you have people trying their best to get to maintain a life, to have some type of maintenance so they could work for a living, and these groups targeted methadone clinics.
James Capper, I appreciate your frontline report. Those are amazing stories, and you've really got a handle on this thing. We're grateful to you for being with us today from the Dallas Field Division of the DEA. Special Agent there, James Capper, thank you very much for joining us. Sam, this is exactly the kind of ingenious or evil genius marketing?
Diabolical, you might say. I think Agent Capper put it right on the money there. I mean, you have to think of all this as in terms of business without morals or without conscience in a sense, because what you're selling, you know, is doing damage. In fact, a lot of these guys I spoke with, they knew this. They kind of felt this moral thing, but they kept selling it anyway.
But you quote somebody in here saying, look, if it's, you know, we're from a poor part of Mexico, and if it's between my kids suffering down here or somebody else's kids suffering up there, if I have to choose, if there's not another way, we'll let their kids suffer and my kids make
money. Well, one thing that this system that these guys devised back in the mid-90s that led to that Operation Tar Pit, eventually the guys that I talked to, a lot of them were busted in that Operation mm-hmm. Tar Pit that Agent Capper referred to. A lot of these guys are, they figured out that there was a whole bunch of very desperate, poor, landless sugarcane farm workers, essentially, mm-hmm. down in the county of Jalisco who just wanted to get out of poverty. They didn't care. The moral question was not a big one for them. For some of them, it did become that, but I think that they're the minority. And indeed, targeting methadone clinics, giving dope away for free. The addict who calls up and who says, I don't want any today, boom, they're right at his door, giving it to him for free.
Yeah,
you don't have
go.
Any money
mm-hmm.
today, mm-hmm. And so that they won't go to a rehab center and start backing away from the dope. They give it to them for free. If you don't have any money, no problem. Today it's free, that kind of thing.
And now you write, down in Jalisco, they've got off the Central Plaza, there's swanky women's clothing stores and law offices and young guys in new Dodge Rams and Ford 150s and new subdivisions. Right. Sean, calling from Boston. Sean, you're on the air.
Hi. I was calling because I just moved from Portland. I lived in Portland.
Oregon, yeah.
Since 2003 in Portland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And we... a friend of mine used to get black tar heroin exactly that way. We could get it in like 10 minutes.
Wow.
And
just call up and it's delivered.
Yeah, and it was cheap. This friend ended up overdosing.
Sorry.
And she was very depressed. So we never were sure if it was purposeful, or if it was, she didn't know how strong it was.
What kind of neighborhood was this in Portland, Oregon, Sean?
It was a beautiful neighborhood. Your typical kind of white middle class neighborhood.
And there they were, right at the door. I'm sorry that she ended up losing her life there. There you go, Sam. There's the story.
That's right. And in fact, Portland was a very interesting case. Speaking with the people in the public health department, they began to realize in the late 90s that they had, unbeknownst to them, because they had missed the record keeping wasn't what it could have been, they had missed a huge surge in heroin overdoses. When they finally began, in deaths, rather, what they, when they finally began to realize what was going on, it took them about 3 or 4 years after the arrival of these dealers from Jalisco. And then what they did, they competed among themselves so heavily that they dropped the price, and that made it more prevalent, more available to a lot of people. As well, their delivery system did the same. After a few years, overdose deaths doubled in that area. The public health department finally had to put together kind of a promotional campaign telling users not to shoot up alone, what to do in mm-hmm. case one overdoses, all these kinds of things, and eventually dropped down a bit. My understanding is it's risen up to late 90s levels now. Mm-hmm. But it's all really due to the fact that these guys were able to deliver it. It was readily available. It was dirt cheap. It went down to like $6, $7, $8 a hit, I believe, something like that, if you bought in bulk. Mm. And it was just a very prevalent thing, and that's what led to all that.
If you want to hear, and this is some shocking sound here, but if you want to hear what gets people into this and then what drags them down, Sam and his team with Gina Ferrazzi have got some amazing tape. Here is a little bit of it, and this is... This is shocking, but this is the a user of black tar heroin, Elaine, I guess a pseudonym, but actually taking it, I guess shooting up, Sam. Yeah. We'll hear that, and then you'll hear just how bad things get. But here's Elaine shooting up black tar.
Oh, burning all around my arm. Oh God. Oh, that was a pretty clean hit, actually.
Sound fun? Not really. Not at all. Listen to her describing, and this is rough, but how hard it is for her to even, in her addiction, to find a vein to get this, to get it in.
Because I've been doing this for so long, I don't have veins left that work, so I have to find places that normal people probably don't know exist. I have to basically spend half an hour tying off my arms or my legs to try and get something to pop out that I can actually see and find and maybe even use. And it takes usually about a dozen tries to get the needle to register so I can actually, plunge it down. It's exhausting.
Sam, she's laughing, but this is no fun. I mean, it makes me squirm just to hear that.
Yeah. And me too. I can tell you, doing this story, I mean, it turns my stomach. Honest to God, it's just so difficult to deal with sometimes. One of the things that's key here is the difference between black tar heroin and white powder heroin.
They
both are highly addictive. They both are very damaging, but black tar adds another level of damage to your body, and that black tar is not purified. It's not processed, and so there's a lot of kind of gunk in the black tar, and that gets into your veins, and that's what she's talking about. She gets clogged veins. The veins kind of get all clogged. You can't use them anymore. Yeah. And then you have to search all over your body for a vein that you can use that's still functional, and then that you can access from the skin. And then after that, what people do is they start muscling, and that means they start sticking it into their muscle because they can't find a vein. This leads to horrible, horrible abscesses, infections, all kinds of nasty things. I talked to one guy who shot up in his right leg so long that he lost his he had to have his leg amputated. It's this kind of infections that this stuff can cause over 3 or 4 years of uses. But it starts with losing your veins. You can't find the veins that you used to use. They just kind of shrivel up and die.
It must drive law enforcement in these small towns crazy when this comes in.
Precisely. I think the other thing that people mention in law enforcement, first of all, on the East Coast or on the east side of the United States, they didn't know what this was. Some cops I talked to had no idea what this was until they really had a problem with it because they'd never seen it before. But also, this system that these guys used to deliver, it's very easy to make arrests. All you need to do is arrest a junkie, put him in a seat for 12 hours. After that, he'll tell you anything you want to know. He'll put you onto the drivers. The drivers, you can follow the drivers for a while, and you can arrest them. But the drivers will quickly be replaced because, as I said, it draws on a whole pool of labor back in Mexico, in Jalisco, Mexico, in Jalisco, Nayarit, in the country of Mexico.
With not much else to fall back on. Sam, hold the thought. We have to take a short break right here. There's a lot more we want to learn. We're looking at the explosion of black tar heroin. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. talking about the explosion of black tar heroin across the country and the door-to-door service and business model that's pushing the drug, very cheap, very potent, deep into Middle America. Sam Quiñones has been with us from Pasadena, California. He's with the Los Angeles Times. They've just published his big series tracking the outbreak. It had been around for a long time, but moving in whole new ways through this country and this society, and based on a very interesting story back in Jalisco, Mexico. We're going to hear in just a moment from Dr. Joe Gay in Ohio, in Athens, Ohio, where they've had real problems lately with this. But first, a couple calls. Leah in Aiken, South Carolina. Leah, you're on the air. Hello, Leah.
Hi,
you're on.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. I was just wondering, the one gentleman said it's easy to take a small amount across, but we must be looking at thousands of drivers, and you said there was a ready supply of drivers. Seems to me if we would control our border better and keep those drivers from coming across, we wouldn't have such a problem with this.
Thank you, Lee. A good question. Sam, how about it? I mean, that's been the issue forever, how do you get that much across?
Well, first of all, it bears noting that one of the quote-unquote benefits, you might say, or business benefits to selling heroin is that you don't have to take that much across. You're not talking about truckloads. You're talking about the amount, one network of sellers, of drivers in a town like Columbus does maybe like a kilo of that a month. You can put a kilo of heroin, it's very concentrated, in like a boom box or something.
So a small volume goes a very long way.
A very, very long way, because you're selling in tenths of a gram. But the caller's point is also, you know, it always gets to this binational issue of controlling the borders, demand in the United States, kind of a latent workforce down in Mexico ready to risk a lot to make something and get ahead financially in their lives and that kind of thing. And it's the whole drug story is about what the caller talked about, just mentioned, I think.
We'll come back to that. Joe in Lewiston, Maine, you're on the air, Joe.
Hi, Tom. Big fan. I really appreciate your neutrality as a reporter.
Thank you, Joe.
I've got a friend that grows it in Maine, not in Lewiston, but out. So if you can grow it.
Grows what? Grows opium poppies?
Opium, okay.
It'll grow in that little tiny summer season you've got in Maine?
Right. If it could be grown in Lewiston, Maine, it could be grown in exactly anywhere in the country with a little love and a little water.
Are you talking grown outside or grown in like a basement with a sunlight deal?
Outside in his garden in the 2.5 months of summer. Now, if it can be grown, and he gets pounds and pounds of the opium, which he processes into black tar or heroin.
Joe, you're not messing with us here. I mean, you're serious.
I'm not. I'm totally truthful with you. And he's actually given me some of the opium, which is the raw constituent.
Yeah.
And I've taken it and taken like a pea-sized amount and put it in my tea.
Yeah.
And it puts me to sleep like a baby. I'm not a junkie, but he sells to people. Now, I certainly appreciate these guys from Dallas and this other man and the awareness that's going on, but I think it's only part of the awareness, and enforcement just doesn't work.
Joe, don't be chewing on too much of that stuff or any. Be careful there, but thank you for your call. Sam, how about that?
I can tell you that I have never heard of that. Ever. I mean, I've heard of it growing in certain climates in Mexico. The grow season, I spoke with an opium farmer one time in another story, and he says the opium season, the grow season lasts 6 months. You cannot grow it in that short of a period of time. Now, I don't know what the it's possible, I suppose. I guess anything's possible. The real problem is not here that you can grow it here. It's that you can grow it very easily in the certain climates in Mexico.
And the volume and the poverty pushing it in. I want to look at one of the communities where this has been a real issue. Dr. Joe Gay joins us from Athens, Ohio, psychologist, executive director of Health Recovery Services. It's a drug treatment and recovery center. His organization serves four semi-rural southeastern Ohio counties, Athens, Vinton, Meigs, and Hawking. They've seen a sharp increase in heroin addiction in the past 4 years. Dr. Joe Gay, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom, and thanks for having me on the show. And hello, Sam, and it was an absolutely wonderful story and very useful.
Thank you very much.
I guess. And before Sam put it all together, your local paper, the Athens News, had seen this. I'm looking at a clipping here from last summer. Heroin epidemic hits county. And they're talking about how people had moved some from OxyContin, oxycodone to heroin, and I guess black tar heroin, Joe Gay.
Yes. We're in a rural area of southeast Ohio, and even though I'm talking about heroin, which is a very unhappy aspect of the community, it's actually our area is a really wonderful area
mm-hmm.
with good people and strong values, but we have just been, there has been an epidemic of heroin use and the use of other opioids. Back in the year 2000, out of about 600 clients we admitted to our services in these four counties,
mm-hmm.
Only six of them were heroin users, and those, for the most part, had developed a heroin problem somewhere else and brought it, they moved
right.
it and brought it with them.
Mm-hmm.
This, starting in, actually in January of 2008, we saw this huge jump in the amount of heroin that we were seeing among our clients. And in the year 2009, fully 30% of the clients in our outpatient clinics were addicted to opioids.
Wow.
About, actually it was more like 32 or 33%, about equally divided between heroin users and users of prescription opioids, particularly OxyContin. And so we've just been overrun with it. And one of the big concerns we have here is the heroin users seem to be much more prone to IV use. Once a person transitions to heroin use, the addiction mm-hmm. really goes out of control. And so 87% of our heroin users are using by injection.
And Dr. Gay, what's your sense of how it suddenly flooded in to your county? You're talking about it being, you know, almost nothing 10 years ago to maybe your most common diagnosis now.
It is our most common diagnosis, and I think, and this is one reason that Sam's article was so useful, because it really, it brought a perspective to this supply issue. I think that we had a population that was primed to use it because they had, over a period of years, the use of opioids, other opioids, the prescription drugs had become.
That's OxyContin and that whole family.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And then it just happened as law enforcement began tightening up on the abuse of prescription opioids, all of a sudden this very cheap heroin became available.
Sam, you write about how pills kind of, as Dr. Gay said, cleared the way for heroin here.
Right,
yes.
And you see this precisely, and I would say OxyContin is the precursor, is the gateway drug to mm-hmm. black tar, most definitely. You've seen a huge increase since the pill was first marketed in the mid-1990s by Purdue Pharma out of Connecticut. You've seen a huge increase in the abuse and addiction to that drug. And I would say it's in a lot of areas like Southern Ohio, West Virginia, Virginia, Pennsylvania, a place like that, where then these guys from Jalisco had kind of were setting up about that time, and they are kind of cresting on that wave of addiction, you know, mm-hmm. to OxyContin. They're seeing that is those guys are the addicts to OxyContin are prime potential candidates or customers for them. And I think what's happened is, again, it gets back to the issue I was talking about earlier. When it sets up, and I believe a lot of the dope that's coming into the area that Dr. Gay serves is coming, most of it's, I think, coming from Columbus, but which is, of course, one of the great centers of Jalisco heroin dealing. A lot of that is then being made available because people just drive into Columbus, you know, and they buy $1,000 worth, go back and sell it back in their hometown, and it all of a sudden becomes an alternative to a very expensive habit. OxyContin, when you really get raging habit, can be $200-$300 a day, and black tar is really more like about at the very highest, you're talking about $80 to $100 a day.
Still a lot of money, but not like the 200.
Not anywhere near. Yeah, and most people have, you know, on the $50 range kind of a habit.
Dr. Gay, how do you look at this? Is this because of economic conditions, unemployment, a change in the culture, or simple availability and this kind of clever pushing?
Well, I think of those choices, I would say availability. We're in an area that's been chronically economically stressed.
Mm-hmm.
Athens County has tended to rank as the highest poverty rate in Ohio for years and years, over 10 years. So the economic situation is a little worse here now than it was, but it's really always been bad. And I think it's really a lot has to do with availability. This is an area that's always had a fairly high tolerance for alcohol and drug use. Our rates of alcohol use and marijuana use have always been high.
Mm-hmm.
And so people have a sort of a favorable attitude towards use of drugs, not necessarily towards addiction, but towards the use of drugs. And once people get into that pattern of drug use, it's a slippery slope. And as Sam has said, as the special agent has said,
yep,
once they start the use of opioids, it's like getting caught in undertow in the ocean.
Yep.
People just get swept away by it.
And especially when it's
a good way of putting it.
Yep. And if there's not enough OxyContin, then heroin becomes an option. As rational people who are not addicted, it's hard to understand why people would do this,
mm-hmm,
but once this starts working on their brain, it becomes a different story. These opioids operate in the part of the brain that is central to pleasure and reward and motivation.
And that
part of the brain overrides rational thought.
And especially when the heroin's just raining down from Jalisco, and when the dealer's there knocking at your door, if you haven't called him, he'll call you. Dr. Joe Gay in Athens, Executive Director of the Health Recovery Services Center there. Dr. Gay, our time is short, but we're grateful to you for being with us today. Thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Susie in Burlington, Vermont. Susie, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I actually just wanted to speak to the point of, thank you for bringing up such a great topic, and I do see it as not as much of a problem as a symptom of something, I think, that's larger existing in society and, what we consider a dangerous drug, where you'd have someone on an upper tier of society, perhaps a corporate CEO of a tobacco company, which I don't even think it's called Philip Morris, is allowed to disguise its name again, competing, and then you've already, as an addict, maybe you're addicted to those legal drugs that I would consider very dangerous. And at a lower tier of society, maybe you see as an adolescent, here there's no job market. We have problems, like major problems that you see as a real, I guess you'd call it a downer, and here's an opportunity where you can go into a place of employment, make all kinds of money, the kind of money that you'd want to make, and...
You mean dealing heroin?
Dealing any kind of drugs. You don't have to wear a uniform, and you don't have to, I think that it's very sad, and I'm not condoning the kind of lifestyle that an addict mm-hmm. or a drug dealer may have, but I do think that it's a symptom of a larger societal problem that is really corroded from even the upper tier.
Yeah. Susie, I appreciate your call. Sam, that may be the case in Burlington. It's certainly the case in Jalisco, you're right. I mean, this is it.
Right.
This is the pillar of the economy there.
And what you have to understand, too, I find this very interesting about Jalisco, is that there's a kind of a semi-feudal class structure where people who have lots of land are fine. They are not the guys coming here to sell their dope, right? It's the folks who are the small farmer or the landless kind of campesino, the landless farm worker who's coming here. And this has, and there's so many of them, and they see that this is a real option to move ahead, that that's one of the reasons why they're always replenished. They get arrested, and there's another one back a few weeks later.
I can imagine our caller Susie thinking we got a little bit of semi-feudalism going on around here sometimes, too. I mean, plenty of people in circumstances where they may take even to dealing drugs with unemployment where it is.
Well, I think you really have to, there may be some similarities. I think there's nothing quite like what exists in a small Mexican village in the United States. I have to say that. I lived down there for a long time.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's not comparable. But the other thing that's interesting is how this has transformed the feudal, the what used to be feudal relations between them. I mean, the guys mm-hmm. with money now, the heroin mm-hmm. dealers, they go back home. They are kind of the social equals with the guy who owns the local grocery store or the relatively large sugarcane farmer or something.
They've got their cattle back now.
Or they have money to pay for the bands in the plaza. Another very interesting thing you'll see in Mexico, if you go to a regular immigrant village, you will see lots of houses in the process of being built. You'll see lots of rebar sticking out of mm-hmm. the first story because
concrete.
They're making money to mm-hmm. make to build the second.
Yep.
In Jalisco, there's no rebar. I've never seen a town like that in Mexico with no rebar.
The houses just go right up on the black tar
money. They have $50,000 to put up the house, boom. And where in other villages, amassing that kind of money may take 10 years.
How does this end, Sam? Many callers have asked, you know, how does this end?
That's beyond my pay grade. What can I tell you? I mean, you know, OxyContin, that's a big issue if you're just talking about black tar. If you're talking about the overall drug issue Mexico-U.S. relations, I think Mexico has to begin to do the things that it really knows what it has to do to begin to free up opportunity for kids. Guys like these who come north, most of them, believe me, they may be nefarious types and use diabolical methods, but most of them would probably rather be back home. And so it becomes really a question of what Mexico's willing to do to begin to transform itself now that it's able to, now that it's no longer a one-party state.
So, Sam Quiñones.
It's a big question.
Yep. Wow. Author of True Tales from Another Mexico and of the big series in the Los Angeles Times that's just run on the explosion of black tar heroin and the story behind it in this country. Terrific reporting, Sam, and we're grateful to you for being with us today. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Sam Quiñones. Listeners, thank you for joining us. It's always great having you here, and thanks for your calls and insights from all over. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.